my girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby.
It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farach. We're listening to Where Did You Sleep Last Night by Huddy Ledbetter, more famously known as Lead Belly. Fans of the band Nirvana may recognize this song from when the band covered it for their 1993 MTV Unplugged performance.
This week marks a birthday for Lead Belly, and here to talk about the musical impact of this legendary folk and blues singer, we're joined by Kip Lernell. He is a music professor at George Washington University and co-author of the book The Life and Legend of Lead Belly. Kip, thanks for joining us.
You're most welcome.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Lead Belly's early years. Where did he come from?
Well, he grew up around the Arklatecs. Ironically, he grew up very close to where my spouse lives, around Shreveport, Louisiana. He was born right on the Texas-Louisiana border just at the time the oil booms were getting going. And he's buried in Latex, Louisiana, which is probably about 24, 44, very close to the border of Texas-Louisiana, which is where he grew up.
Now, I hate to ask the obvious question, but how did he get the name Lead Belly?
Well, the usual story is when he was in prison for the second time, which was down in Sugar Land, Texas, down near Houston, he was not a very large man, contrary to what a lot of people think. He was probably only about 5'8 or 5'9, but he was very, very strong. And after all that work he'd done picking cotton in East Texas in the 19-teens, he was in prison in the early 1920s, but his stomach was so strong it felt like it was built out of lead.
Hmm. Well, this guy has an influence that looms large even today. What do we know about how he went from picking cotton to being such a huge, towering musical figure?
Well, it's a story that Hollywood would love, in fact, did to a small degree. There's actually a film from 1976 by Gordon Park called Lead Belly, which really talks about his early life, and it begins with him being discovered, so to speak, in Angola prison by John and Alan Lomax in 1933. And what happened was the Lomaxes were going through southern prisons in 1933, and then they went again in 1934 looking for what they thought would be untainted folk talent. And they would write ahead to wardens of prisons and say, we're coming through to do recordings for the Library of Congress. And Angola, which is in south central Louisiana, not far from Baton Rouge, was where Lead Belly was incarcerated at the time for attempted manslaughter. And the warden recommended that the Lomaxes go by to see him when they were the summer of 1933. And you can imagine what the prison would be like in August of 1933. But he recorded selections for them. The Lomaxes came back again in 34, and it's a little bit more long and complicated with this, but they enabled him to a degree to get out of prison a little bit early. And he joined them on another song-hunting expedition in the fall of 1934. And the Lomaxes, particularly John, was headed up to New York, and Lead Belly went along with him to some of the prisons in Alabama and Arkansas and ended up in New York in the just before, right around Christmas of 1934. And when you look at the headlines in newspapers in New York in 1935, it's, sweet singer of the swampland comes to New York. A murderer comes to sing in our town. So it was really quite sensationalized. And that's how Lead Belly ended up in New York, was just utter caprice in many ways.
Let's get another taste of his music. Here is Midnight Special.
Yonder come a Miss Rosie, in the world do you know? Well, I know about a April and a dress she wore. I'm a river on the shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. Well, I'm going and ask the governor, he's trying to lose my man, lift the midnight special, shine a light on me.
Now, this is a song I've heard covered by a lot of musicians over the years. What is the story behind that song, Kip?
Well, the Midnight Special was a train that ran near the prison in Sugar Land, and it brought people to visit the inmates, among other things. And when he's talking about the Light of the Midnight Special, it's kind of a metaphor for bringing some hope to the prisoners who were there. Leadbelly was in Sugar Land from about 1919 to about 1924, 1925. And so he and all of his fellow prisoners who were there were hoping the Midnight Special would bring somebody to visit them there in prison.
It sounds like one of the things he was known for was his talent on a 12-string guitar, maybe the thing that he's known for. He had a special way of playing it, didn't he?
He did. He had a very strong bass line that he played on guitar, which is what it really impresses a lot of people. But people should also be aware that in addition to his prowess on the 12-string guitar, which he picked up probably around 1912 or 1913, about the same time he met Blind Lemon Jefferson. They were together for probably about 6 months or so. He also was a fairly accomplished accordion player, and he also made some recordings on piano. You know, he started off playing guitar and started playing in what was called Suki Jumps, which were kind of the down-home weekend blowouts that people had on Saturday nights. And he learned from his uncle Terrell, you know, learned to play accordion and play guitar. But the 12-string guitar didn't come until he was in his 20s at that point. That's what he became famous for. However, in addition to that was the accordion and piano. And also he did a lot of unaccompanied either religious songs and field hollers, too. So he had really quite an extensive ability to accompany himself on a number of instruments. And also he was really quite an accomplished singer, too.
Well, let's get another listen to him now. This is a song I'm not familiar with, Bourgeois Blues.
Oh, it's a bourgeois man who lived in a bourgeois town. I got a bourgeois blues, and I'm sure gonna dread the news. Yes, I'm gonna.
Kip, you laughed when I said the song title there. Why?
Well, earlier today, I was in that bourgeois town.
Really?
Oh, yes. We live less than a mile from Washington, D.C. We live in Silver Spring, Maryland. I teach at George Washington University, which is very close to the White House. And that song is about Huddy Ledbetter being in New York in the late, I'm sorry, being in Washington, D.C., visiting from New York, and having a difficult time finding a place for him to stay in a bourgeois town like Washington, D.C. He was at that time still quite involved with Alan Lomax, and I suspect that Alan had a bit of a hand in shaping this song, but think of it as a fairly important early protest song about conditions where blacks were not able to stay in the same kind of places that whites were. And so I found that humorous. It was a song I suggested was worth playing, but having lived around this bourgeois town since 1988, it has kind of a special meaning for me as well.
Leadbelly is a name that you hear when you hear musicians talking about their influences a lot, even to this day. What do you think that influence has been?
Wow, it has been profound and in many ways. I know that when Charles Wolfe and I were working on this biography, which came out in 1993, I ended up doing more of the interviews because that was just before we had kids and Charles was teaching at Middle Tennessee State and couldn't travel as much. And I vividly recall visiting Pete Seeger in New York. And, you know, Pete said, you know, that was Leadbelly. He really introduced so many people firsthand to what we had only heard on records, live Southern black blues and folk music. And so it wasn't only those live performances that captured Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and so many others. Fortunately, he recorded quite a bit, especially by way of Mo Ash for Ash Records and eventually Folkways and Smithsonian Folkways. And that legacy is something that has really gone and, you know, was well regarded at the time, but has stayed in print. And if you look at the number of recordings Leadbelly has available, he really has had a profound impact, not only when he was alive up through 1949, but his recorded legacy has been well cared for, too.
Kip, like a lot of people, I probably have felt Leadbelly's influence secondhand through the other musicians you're talking about. Briefly, should we all be going back and checking out Leadbelly, listening to the real deal?
Well, I always think, since my major interest is you know, grassroots American vernacular music. You caught me working on a book on bluegrass in Washington, D.C., as the call came in. People should always look at the grassroots. They should look at where things came from. You mentioned Nirvana, but, you know, Cotton Fields Back Home was a song that was, you know, Lead Belly's interesting. Did he write Cotton Fields Back Home? He at least shaped that song, and it's properly attributed to him. Whether that copyright illegally should be his is a whole other matter. But that was covered by the Beach Boys. If you listen to blues singers from, and you know, blues rockers from Britain, if you listen to people from the folk revival, Lead Belly's tentacles are in a lot of surprising places.
Kip, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
That's Kip Larnell. He's a music professor at George Washington University, co-author of the book The Life and Legend of Lead Belly. Good Night Irene by Lead Belly coming up under us there.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about why undersharing on Facebook is now a bigger crime than oversharing, according to our guest.
First, the speed limit in Wisconsin could be going up under a new bill announced by two state lawmakers yesterday. The bill would allow the State Department of Transportation to increase speed limits on state highways to 70 miles per hour, up from the current limit of 65.
The idea passed in the Assembly during the last session, failed to gain traction in the Senate. Now, one of the lawmakers behind that initial effort is leading the charge once again. In a little bit, we'll take your calls on the idea at 800-642-1234, or you can post right now at the Central Time Facebook page.
Paul Tittle joins us now. He's a Republican state representative from Manitowoc and is one of the authors of that speed limit bill. Representative Tittle, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All right, well, we'll start with that big question. Why do you think the speed limit should be raised to 70 miles per hour?
Well, actually, when you get down to it, it's the number one reason is it's all about safety. And some people say, well, that would fly in the face of safety. If you're going faster, wouldn't that make it unsafe? Well, actually, there are studies out there that talk about the 85th percentile, which means that you get 85% of all the people going on or about the same speed. You actually create the safest roadway. The biggest variance is in speed, actually, the darting in and out. That's actually more dangerous on the roadway, and that's where more accidents can happen.
What's wrong with 65 miles an hour? I mean, that's close to 70. Maybe it feels a little bit safer to some drivers who don't really feel safe going 70.
Well, I think basically if you start driving out on the roadway, I challenge anybody, drive 65 once. And I did that all the way from Manitowoc to Madison right before I proposed the bill last time. And you will find that there is the roadways are not at 65. People are going above that, and your average speed is when you can try to get, again, some people will probably bump it up, and then some people will, you know, maybe slow it down. Missouri, when they raised their speed limit from 65 to 70, they found that the average speed only went up 1 mile per hour. So there's some naysayers out there that will say, well, you know, if we now are doing 72, they're going to do 77, 78. People are still only going to drive what they're most comfortable driving.
Well, what roads would this apply to? Just interstates?
Well, that's what's nice about this bill. It's probably as simple a bill as the Wisconsin legislature has ever been able to take up. We take it into Wisconsin statutes. Right now, the DOT could set the speed limits on the roadways, but the maximum speed limit that they can set on any roadway is 65. So we're going to basically take out and we're going to put an X through 65 and put 70 on there. It's not a very long or complex bill, and we're going to let the traffic safety engineers do the deciding on what roads that they deem that would be safe enough to be traveled at 70. You know, this goes way back to 1973, back in the early energy crisis of the early 70s. And then the federal government mandated that no state could have a speed limit higher than 55. If you did, you would suffer because they would take away some of your federal transportation dollars. Well, that got repealed back in 1995, and many states went raised their speed limit to 65 and above after the repeal of that. And the roads, I've talked to some old-timers, they tell me that there was two-lane roads way back when that actually had speed limits of 70 miles per hour. And right now, primarily you're going to see this on interstates or four-lane highways and what have you. Our roads are built to handle it, And also, our cars are a lot safer. I remember growing up as a child, we did not have to have seat belts on, and kids weren't even required to be in a car seat, believe it or not, in the 70s. And now we're talking about mandatory child restraint seats. We have shoulder straps on everyone. We have airbags in cars. The world is a little bit different now, and it's a lot safer world out there.
Maybe one thing Wisconsin has that might distinguish it from other neighboring states who've gone up to 70 miles an hour, we have a drunk driving problem in the state. And if you've got drivers going 70 miles an hour in a state that has an alcohol problem, don't you have more fatalities, at least more accidents?
Well, you know, the drunk driving issue, I believe, is another issue that we'll be able to maybe address in this session. I'm hoping that we will. I think that there are issues with that. And I have done several ride-alongs with police departments. And when I've done the ride-alongs, generally the people that are inebriated or have way too much to drink, they're not the ones that are going excessive speeds. In fact, a lot of them, they're going a lot slower, and that's how police can actually find them. But that's a whole separate issue, and I'm sure that we'll be able to be addressing any drunk driving law changes in the state this session as well.
Now, you've said it's safer because people are sort of more or less going the same speed instead of having some slow drivers and fast ones darting in and out. But when you do have those crashes, are they more likely to result in fatalities because of those extra five, maybe five plus miles an hour?
Well, that's a great question, and that brings me up to our neighbors to the south of us, Illinois, which, as you know, up until recently had a democratically controlled legislature and a Democratic governor. And in 2013, they actually passed their speed limit to 70 on their some of their roadways. And so January 1st of 2014, they raised their speed limit. When they raised their speed limit to 70, the year prior, they had 991 fatalities on their roadways. Their first year of the 70 mile per hour, actually they went down to 926. So they actually went down. And there's other states. It's not a sole one state that you can look at. There's other states that have done it. Iowa had a similar result in 2005 to 2006. They went from 450 to 439. Indiana, in 2005, they went to 70 miles per hour. 3 years later, Purdue University did a comprehensive study, and they concluded that the increased speed did not increase the probability of suffering any severe injury or accident. So there is a lot of data out there, and when you simply look at the facts, that's why I say this is a very simple bill, and you have to look at the facts, not what we think will happen, but look at the facts of what actually does happen when you do adjust it. Because we have enough other states, there's 38 states right now that have a speed limit above 65. There are some of them, and we have a map, and you could go to our website, Wisconsin State Representative Paul Tittle, my Facebook page, you can see the map. We are now an island all the way from the state of Washington to Pennsylvania, and there are some states that have 75, there are some that have 80, there's even one state that has some maximum speed limits of 85 miles per hour.
So you proposed this idea during the last session of the state legislature, and it passed the assembly, it stalled out in the Senate, now it's back again, you're making the case for it once more. Do you think that it has the support it needs to pass this time around?
I think it does. The bill is changed from the last one. We went into so far as picking out different segments of highway and saying this should go and this one shouldn't, this one should, this one shouldn't. Well, I talked with leadership and I said, let's do this. Let's trust and let the safety engineers do their job, because that's what they do all the time. We are legislators. We're not studying road safety. And the one thing is that I would not even bring forth this bill if I thought for 1 minute that it would actually create an unsafe roadway. I think it. I have two wonderful grandchildren, a daughter and a son. I want to make these roads safe, and we travel all over the state to visit them. They don't live in our town of Manitowoc anymore, and they come to see us. So I don't want to create anything that could possibly be a hazard and that would put anybody in danger.
Now, if this were passed, how quickly do you think it could go into effect?
Well, in my mind, I would love to see this taken up in the early part of this session. There's a lot of bills that are working on. There'll be the governor's budget will be given out in just a little bit under 2 weeks from now, and then they'll have to go through the hearings and stuff. So we have some stuff to do in this early part of the session, and I think we could get this done early. My idea of what it would be great would be to have it on the governor's desk by the end of March for a signature so that we could actually see some of the roads starting to change for the summer tourism season. I think it could be good for all of us.
Representative Tittle, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes. One other thing, a point if I'd like to make, is that I've talked with the Department of Transportation, and there's no new money that's going to be needed in order to produce the signs. A lot of people have asked me, I was like, well, how much is this going to cost? Well, let me just tell you, they've assured me they have a sign replacement program within their budget, and they've assured me that they can absorb that within their sign replacement
program. All right,
program.
So maybe no new money for signs. That was Paul Tittle we're talking to, their Republican state representative from Manitowoc, talking about maybe bumping up the speed limit to 70 miles per hour.
And we want to hear from you on this now at 800-642-1234. Do you think that we should increase the maximum speed limit to 70 miles an hour, applied selectively where it's safe on highways around the state? What do you think could be done to do it safely? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get to your calls right after this check of the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, we're talking about raising the speed limit. What do you think? Should Wisconsin raise its speed limit to 70 miles per hour? That's the question on the table. We just heard from Representative Paul Tittle. He just reintroduced a bill in the state legislature that would bump up the state speed limit. And now it's your turn to chime in at 800-642-1234.
Would you support raising the state speed limit from 65 to 70 in selected locations? Why make the case for it? Or do you worry that extra 5 miles an hour would cause a safety hazard, other problems? Want to see it stay at 65 or, I don't know, even go lower? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
All right, we're going to kick things off with Tom in Mequon. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think about raising the speed limit to 70?
Well, thanks for asking for my advice. I think that it's a great idea, and if I could point out that I think that should be for automobiles and cars and pickup trucks, not for semis. I think they should stay at 65, and especially they should stay in the right lane unless they're passing. If you drive, especially the two-lane highways with these semis in both lanes, it's terrible.
Okay, not for semis. What do you like about the idea for cars and small trucks?
Well, I travel quite a bit, and honestly, I've been to many other states, and there's really no issue. I find, too, if you drive a little faster, you actually pay attention to the road a little more. If you're down to 55, it's tiring, and it's boring. Lastly, if I could ask for the moon, too, on those dump trucks that they could put the covers over them so the sand and the rocks doesn't come out and hit your cars. I've lost two windshields like in the last 4 years, and that's something I wish could be done too. But I think for cars, it's not a bad thing.
All right. Well, thanks, Tom. And I've been with you on that dump truck thing. Who knows if that's going anywhere. I don't think that's part of Representative Tittle's proposal here. We'll go next to Sue in Madison. Hi, Sue.
Hi. The point I wanted to raise is that safety is not the only issue here, and in fact, I think we should lower the speed limit. In all of these conversations, the energy conservation part of it seems to be missing. Why do we feel it's our right and it's okay to use all the energy we have available? Why is not conservation not a part of the conversation? And that's really my question.
Okay, interesting point. I appreciate that perspective, Sue. Thank you for calling in. We're going to move next to Joe in Mauston. Hello, Joe.
Hi there. Hey, I'm in favor of it. I spend a lot of time driving because I'm in sales and I go all over the state. You know, and cars are safer today than they ever have been. They're more efficient fuel-wise, so addressing the energy issue that woman just brought up I think it's somewhat irrelevant because we have improved the gas mileage so much on cars and trucks. And the government's even imposing more strict, you know, regulation to improve the energy in car usage. So deaths are down. All the statistics support it. We've got states all around us that have speed limits at 70 miles an hour. You know, I think it's about time we just join the bandwagon and show that we can do it.
All right. Well, thank you for that opinion, Joe. Appreciate that. We're talking about a bill in the Assembly to raise the speed limit to 70 miles per hour. It's up from 65, an extra 5 there, and we'll see if it passes this time around. It didn't last time. It died in the Senate. What do you think? Should the speed limit be raised to 70 miles an hour? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Mike is with us next. Mike joins from Appleton. Mike, hi.
Yeah, I listened to Paul Tittle from Manitowoc, and I think he summed it up perfectly. I also have young children, and I don't think safety is a concern with the improvements cars have made. And I just say I'm for it. I travel a lot to Minnesota and Iowa, and they're at 70. I believe what Purdue University that he talked about, the study, and I think that safety would possibly improve, and it's time that Wisconsin move forward and get this done. Anyway, thanks.
Great. Appreciate your call, Mike. And let's go next to Tom joining us in Pittsville. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hey, I drive truck for a living, and I am totally against it.
Okay, why?
Because there are a lot of bad drivers. You know, these people that say, hey, I drive a lot and I'm bored, turn your radio on. I mean, I drive 150,000 miles a year. I drive 60 when the speed limit's 70 because, number one, it's fuel savings. And there's so many drivers that I see these people texting, talking where they shouldn't be. They don't care if they're going 70 or 80. If you raise it to 70, they're going to drive 80. Here's the other thing. Jump on the freeway at Hudson and head to Milwaukee down I-94. If you were in a car, you better be in the left lane because nobody drives 65 anyway. If you ask the state patrol, they don't write a ticket until you hit 80. And if the flow is running 80, they'll let them go. I mean, the people are driving way too fast. I see more wrecks, and it's, you know, the roads are icy. People got their cruise control on. They hit a bridge deck, ice, boom, crash. It just doesn't need to be. I wish they'd lower it for the rest of the United States. And tons of guys that I work with, I mean, they'll throw sticks at me and say, you're nuts. But if you lower it a little bit, 5 miles an hour is huge fuel savings in my semi, let alone what it is in the cars.
Interesting. So you're in the big rig, and you can see what everyone's doing down there in your cars, and you're seeing unsafe driving. You want to lower it. Well, Tom, appreciate that perspective, one a lot of us don't have. We're not up there in the semi with you. Appreciate that call, Tom. You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Should we bump up the speed limit here in Wisconsin, like a lot of our neighboring states have done, to 70 miles per hour? You can weigh in right now, and we go to John next in La Crosse. Hi, John.
Hi, hello.
What do you think?
I think that not only should they raise the speed limit, I think that they should raise the minimum. I see so many people driving 10 under the speed limit on a highway, and when they get into town, then they say they're going 45 and a 55. They're going 45 and a 25 now. And the slower people seem to be the ones causing the most problems.
Okay. Well, thanks. Appreciate that. That's an interesting point, too. We've got a tweet here from Gary who says, I think we have enough traffic deaths due to the current speed limit. Driver education and competency regulations should come first. That from Gary on Twitter. And we're going to go now to Peter. Peter's joining us in Whitewater. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of add to Sue's comment. You talked about gas conservation. I think it's really going against any notions of environmental improvements that we'd like to see because, yes, we have more efficient cars, but that doesn't mean we're not going to have a great deal more usage of gasoline by increasing the speed limit. So there's no way I can be in favor of that when all it is doing is really, really injustice to our environment by sending that much more pollutant out into the road. And I think the argument by Representative Tittle regarding the safety is really poorly looked at, because you can't do a study where you do something for 3 years and then compare it to three previous years, because you have a very unequal comparison there of different eras, different activities that might be going on. So I think that's a poor comparison or a poor look at safety. So I think it's silly to believe that it would be a safer practice to go 70. But my biggest concern is really the environmental one, where we have a huge environmental problem. If anybody watched the State of the Union address by the president, I mean, it's clear, and we're just going to be flooding our environment with more CO2 emissions if we increase that speed limit.
Okay, got it, Peter. Thank you so much for calling and telling us what you think. We've got a couple comments here on Facebook. Mary says, no, I agree. Most people don't go exactly the speed limit, and frankly, they irritate me when they do. But really, for 5 miles per hour more, how much money will be expended making new signs? Representative Tittle says it's not going to cost any money for new signs, at least at this point. Educating the public, she says, is another cost she's worried about, not to mention more gas usage. I think it's ridiculous. Joe writes, the average American spends 5.42 years in a car in their average life of 76 years. At 7% increase in speed limit, it would give us all 0.4 more years to enjoy our lifetimes. I know it's not perfect, complete logic, but it seems like a good idea to me. So 0.4 more years, not in your car. So that's an interesting angle there, Joe. Appreciate your comment on Facebook. We're going to leave it there. I want to thank everybody for your calls and your comments. And we're going to be watching this one closely as the bill moves through the state legislature.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Republicans and Democrats are clarifying their priorities for the coming budget debate. We'll look at who wants what.
First, it used to be that oversharing on Facebook was the biggest taboo. Posts about vasectomies, photos of breakfast fell into the too much information category. But our next guest says over the last year or two, the bigger crime is undersharing.
And in recent days, the New York Times has published a piece suggesting that only posting from the highlight reel of our marriages is doing everybody a disservice and hurting future partnerships.
And our next guest takes it further. She says we have an obligation to speak out on social media about politics and important social issues, because the days of polite disengagement are over, even if you end up starting an online dust-up.
Phoebe Maltz-Bovey joins us now. She wrote about undersharing on Facebook for The Atlantic. Phoebe, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks so much for having me on.
So why is undersharing, as you see it on social media, now a bigger crime than oversharing?
Okay, well, first I'd like to just make a little something clear. So the piece I wrote for The New Republic was saying that something has shifted in the culture. So I don't think that people should share more about their personal lives. But I think what's changed in the culture is it's now taken for granted that people are sharing everything. So whereas people used to be criticized for sharing too much, I think there's now a shift where people are criticized for sharing too little. And I think that people are criticized both in terms of their personal life sharing and in terms of their political sharing. And where I came out on this was basically that people should continue to undershare as much as possible about their personal lives. People should keep things private about their personal lives and not reveal too much about their friends and loved ones. But when it comes to politics, I think it's a bit different, as I'll get into.
Why politics? Why do we need to get our opinions out there and post about them on Facebook? Because, you know, we might offend people that we know. We might offend friends and colleagues.
Exactly. And this is something that I'm a bit ambivalent about. This is not, I'm not coming on to say everybody should share everything about politics or that nobody should share anything. What I think is basically that people shouldn't just assume political sharing is annoying because it's happening on social media. I think that is, it's political speech like any other kind, and if you feel moved to speak out about something, you shouldn't refrain from doing so because it's somehow upsetting the tone of social media. But I think if you genuinely think you're going to be fired for writing something political or that you'll be completely ostracized from everybody you know, it's a different story.
What does that silence say when there is a big topic of conversation, say in the news? Most recently, one of the examples you write about is the Black Lives Matter movement. And in that case, you point to people who pointed out that the silence on social media pages gave a message. What did it say?
Right. Well, this is really something that had changed how I thought about this issue, because I tend to be very much in favor of keeping things offline, of not sharing too much of anything. But then some of my friends were posting and sharing things, basically saying, why are my, they would sometimes specify, white Facebook friends talking about or sharing cat videos or, you know, things like that, and not talking about Ferguson. And I think what this said, it wasn't saying that any one person is wrong for sharing a cat video. What it was saying is that you can see something about the general attitudes of different groups in society by what they do and don't post. And I think you can get interesting information from this. I think where it gets dangerous is if individuals are being condemned for not sharing, considering each person is in a different situation in terms of where they'd end up if they shared too much.
So what would you say to encourage people to share? I mean, does it add to the greater dialogue out there and also raise social awareness that there is something going on when
exactly.
people share?
Exactly. That's exactly right. I think that not everybody feels in a position to have an opinion about everything, and I certainly don't have opinions about everything that's going on in the world that I'd be prepared to put online. But I think that if you're plugged into what's going on in the news, just sharing an article, not everybody's necessarily reading a newspaper these days. Some people really are getting their news from Facebook, from Twitter, things like that. And rather than thinking that you're going to be annoying people by sharing something, maybe you are going to be informing people. And I think, again, that it depends. If you're somebody in some very sensitive position where if you share any article about anything, you'll be fired from your job, maybe you're not the person to be doing this.
But you do write about how, you know, just the way, let's say you're at out to dinner and someone makes a comment that's racist, that you sort of have a moral obligation to speak up about it, that Facebook might not be that different.
Right. I think that's right. I think I think the same way somebody is considered courageous for speaking up and cowardly for not speaking up offline extends to the internet. And I think that it's a different sort of sharing. It's not the same. I don't think there's any ethical obligation, to be clear, to share about your family crises. I think, if anything, the ethical obligation is in the other direction, to not share these things. But I think it's a type of, it's not that one status update is the same as becoming an activist and truly changing the world, but it's getting ideas out there. It's being part of a general sort of conversation about politics.
And at the same time, the political speech that we see a lot of the time on Facebook, it can get rough, it can get personal and nasty. Does that really add to the discourse? You know, you've got that disconnect because you're essentially a computer talking to another computer. You're not face-to-face. Is that really upping the level of discourse?
Well, I think I haven't seen so much nastiness, and I think it all depends on which forum, since the internet is quite huge. But I think if it's on a forum like Facebook, if it's mostly people who are using their real names and have some, however slight, interest in not just being trolls, the discourse can be actually quite productive.
Do you think it's getting old-fashioned not to share things, especially, you know, these opinions you're talking about politics and current events?
I just think the norm has really shifted where, and this is something I wrote about more actually in an article for Tablet that was about a professor who's very active on social media, but I think the norm really just about 10 years ago, like when I first started having a blog and things like that, the norm was to be a little suspicious of anybody using the internet to share anything. And that in and of itself was suspect. And I think now that view has become passé and people are more inclined to assume that somebody's sharing and to be critical of that which is left offline. But I think that something has kind of... I think that there's actually quite a bit of overlap between the objections to overshare and undershare. I think there's just a general discomfort with sort of super positive, curated sharing that is typical on Facebook. And I think it's now expressing itself as saying that people should share more of the negative stuff rather than just share less.
All right. Well, let's talk about that marriage article that ran in the New York Times. It had a lot of people commenting on it. You say you still are about people showing more discernment, being more curatorial about what they put out there. Don't put everything out there. But is there a point to be made by, you know, that we're not doing people favors if we don't post some of the negative stuff, at least even about our personal lives?
Well, I think negative, I think there are a few different things that are negative. I think there's sort of the humble brag negativity, which is just, it gets a bad name, but obviously going on Facebook and saying, I'm wonderful, my family is perfect, and all of that, it grates. It does. But I think once you get into things where you're sharing about other people and not just about yourself, which is most personal sharing sort of ends up there, I think that the disservice that does to the family, friends, especially when it's somebody's children, I think that that just so outweighs whichever broader sort of taboo shedding it might do in society. I think there are other forms for that. There are news articles where the writer isn't also the relative. There's fiction, there are movies, there are other ways to learn about human suffering, interpersonal relations other than status updates or personal essays.
What about expressly about marriages, which was the focus of that article? You know, the point being that if we're not posting about the difficulties, the hard work that can go into marriage, we might actually be pointing people toward bad marriages themselves.
I think there's just so much information about what marriage is like, other than even without any Facebook posting. I think people hopefully still, maybe this is a quaint view, I think people do still interact offline and know one another, know their families, know their friends. I think people read novels. I think people watch television shows. I think movies. I think people still understand that marriages are not, you know, a wedding photo and then 5 years later a vacation photo. Because what seemed so strange about that article was that the criticism wasn't that people were posting the lovey-dovey updates, but that people just weren't saying anything about their marriages, which just seemed sort of, that seems very strange to me.
Well, the stuff we put on social media, it seems like it has an unending shelf life, that it's going to be up there forever. And in terms of marriages, you can see the case that you might not want something up there forever. But also for the political discourse you're talking about, that may be up there long after you may even have changed your mind about something. So why should we go out on a limb and post it?
Well, I think in terms of the political postings, I think it's really just a question of if you believe in something strongly and you think, or even if it's not that you have a particular position, but even if you just think something is important that's happening in the world, that's the moment to share it. And I can't imagine somebody regretting posting about Ferguson in some general sense. It just seems, it's hard for me to picture that somebody would think that they should have just said, oh, nothing was happening in the world, the end. I think that would be strange.
Well, Phoebe, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate
your
time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We've been speaking with Phoebe Mulls-Bovey. She's a freelance writer based in New Jersey. Her work has appeared in The New Republic, The Atlantic, and Tablet.